455, October 19. Okay, so we have a good projector. Nice, first time ever in Sloan, my experience. So before we go on and talk about the link layer, Sean raised an interesting question with respect to the homework, and let me see if I can find it now. Let's see, wrong chapter, P37. So it's specifically, it's about P37, which has a diagram that is one of these window size versus time diagrams that starts out looking like this, and then it goes like this, and then it goes down and goes like this, and then down and like so. Okay. And the important thing that I want to point out along here is that the labels here, 2, 4, 6, 8, and so forth. And the axis here is labeled transmission round. Okay? And it's important to realize that the transmission round is really essentially a round trip time. It's not a single packet transmission. So you know, at transmission round two, it isn't that we've transmitted two packets, it's that we've gone through two round trip times. Okay? And Sean's question specifically was, how do we know what happened here? Was that a transition from slow start to congestion avoidance, or was it a transition to fast recovery? And that stumped me for a bit. So it was a good question. It stumped me for a bit. But I think if you look at the behavior of fast recovery, you'll see that fast recovery actually acts like slow start, not like congestion avoidance, right? So when you're in fast recovery, you're actually doing a exponential window size growth with every round trip time, okay? And so this is clearly a transition then to congestion avoidance. Okay? But I thought it was worth pointing out, because it's easy to make this mistake, that these are not the packet transmissions, these are round trip times here.
How do you determine the value of SS threshold for the start?
If you look at the diagram, the state diagram, on page 286, it's figure 3.52, it shows an initial transition into the slow start stage with a threshold of 64 kilobytes. Now, how that relates to this diagram where it shows 32-ish segments as being the transition, I don't know. But anyway, that was how I sort of came to this conclusion. The other thing that I might as well point out, as long as we're talking about it, is that when I attempted to implement a simulation based on figure 3.52, it became apparent that there were a few mistakes in that figure. They're not terribly significant, but in the transition from slow start to fast recovery, the current window is set to SSH thresh plus 3 segment sizes, not 3. And you know, it could be, well, it's just inconsistent from one place to the next. So that there's one of those there. There's a transition from fast recovery to congestion avoidance that has the same problem. And the transition from fast recovery to slow start also has that problem. So anyway, so those plus threes and plus ones and ones are all expressed in terms of segment sizes.
Sorry, another question about this. I don't know, I spent some time in just looking at it and ended up looking at the answer for it. And for congestion avoidance, if it's in congestion avoidance and this first...
This one here?
Stroke right here.
Yeah.
And then it deflates rapidly right there
because
it's using quick recovery.
Fast recovery.
Fast recovery. So.
Yeah.
All the answers I've looked at least said that like, it's going back into congestion avoidance again in that second one.
This is also congestion avoidance.
And I'm confused by how does it go from congestion avoidance, then drop it, and go back into congestion avoidance again immediately?
Well, fast recovery doesn't last very long, is the quick answer.
The question is then, if fast recovery doesn't last very long, will I ever see it on the graph? Will I see a linear growth somewhere on a graph, or do I just see those drops?
I think you usually just see those drops.
Okay.
It is interesting that it doesn't actually show the fast recovery stage on the diagram usually.
That's actually within that second ascent. It's actually both.
No. Well, there's a small little. Element there where it may be fast recovery, but the overall global sort of steady state picture is like this, and that's what matters.
I basically said that since there was a fast recovery, that was why it cut to the halfway point instead, and that was like,
right. Yeah, and then you don't see it doing fast recovery when it's in there. Yeah, but that's because. I now understand why. Because notice what the scale is here. It's only showing you points associated with a full time slot, okay? Or a full round trip time. And so fast recovery recovers in one round trip time.
Okay?
That's why it's fast, I guess. Okay? Cool. Anyway. Great, thanks for the question. That was useful, and my remembering that I needed to answer it was also interesting. Okay, so now we're at the link layer. And do you want all the lights on now? If I put all the lights on, would that? Yeah, cool. And he said, you know, and then they're going to rip this out in May and install all new stuff. So, because they're going to redo this building next summer. Right. After you've suffered through it all this time. Okay, so link layers. So remember, the link layer is concerned with transmission of frames containing packets between one point and an adjacent point in the network without a router involved. And it tends to be sort of the closest networking thing to the, that we'll talk about in computer science anyway, to the actual physical layer of the way things work. So the link layer is the place that we sort of see the physical characteristics a bit without actually having getting down to electrons and photons. All right. So what do we do? We've got a datagram coming from the network layer. And, you know, our usual answer as we go down a layer is to wrap that in a header set of bits that say what's going on at the link layer, possibly add a trailer of some more bits, ensure that the frame now gets put on the link in such a way that it doesn't interfere with other frames on the link. We have addressing at the link layer to make sure that the frame goes and is received by the appropriate host on the link if it's a shared link, broadcast link. And then the other thing that may happen at the link layer is reliable delivery. And we already talked about the algorithms for reliable delivery. Remember, that was go back in and selective acts and all that stuff. We talked about it at the transport layer, but some link layers also implement reliable delivery. And the question that it's worth thinking about is, why would you have both? Okay? So let's talk about that for a second. And to understand why you need both, think about TCP and what TCP interprets a missing packet to mean. How does TCP interpret a missing packet? Well, you can't interpret the packet. Interpret the fact that it's missing. What does sort of in general terms, what does that mean to TCP? What does it mean to TCP when a packet is missing?
Oh, congestion.
Congestion.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. But at the link layer, a missing packet, a damaged packet, is often much more associated with interference, corruption of the data, lots of sort of physical layer things that can go wrong. And the appropriate response when one of those things goes wrong is not to interpret as congestion, which says slow down, but rather send it again as soon as you can, right? Because that's the only way it's going to get through. It has nothing to do with interference or anything. It has to do it has nothing to do with congestion. It has to do with something went wrong on the at the more physical layer. So unreliable links tend to have link layer at least acknowledgments and retransmissions, or you may build in something like the error correction codes that we're going to talk about here in a few minutes. Okay, so you understand that? I mean, this was actually one of the, when wireless was first becoming available, and wireless networking was first becoming available when I was working at Park, this was one of the lessons that we learned. We were trying to build some wireless hardware and run TCP over it, and it just performed terribly. And it was because TCP was just so unaggressive about sending data. There'd be loss in the wireless component of the network, and TCP would just sort of go to sleep for a long time. and that's not what we were after. So that's a very important point. Okay, we've seen flow control also at the transport layer. It may be needed at the link layer as well. But same sort of techniques that we talked about before. Error detection. Now, we've seen error detection at the transport layer in the form of the UDP and TCP checksums, right? Again, why do you have it at the link layer as well? What advantage do you get by having it at the link layer? Well, one possibility is that that you actually extend it to error correction and fix the problem sort of before the upper layer ever notices. The other reason for doing it at the link layer is that, again, if you have a what is termed a noisy channel, one that's corrupting a lot of frames, if you don't kill them at that point, they continue to consume resources as they traverse the network, and then they get to the end and they're no good, right? So that's, you might as well kill them as soon as you see them, okay? And finally, just a term that networkers like to use is half duplex, meaning a link that can send in both directions, that's the duplex part, but only in one direction at a time, right? So that's called half duplex links. And full duplex is still, you can send in both directions, but now you can send in both directions at once. And most of what we see these days is full duplex links. Questions? How does it get implemented? It's not so easy to show anymore because we used to have cards that we had to put in our laptops that to do wireless networking, and that was called a network interface card. We used to have cards that we had to put in our desktop computers. That was called a network interface card. That's where the link layer sort of meets the physical layer. And often there's firmware on those cards that does part of the work of the link layer, and a software driver in the operating system does the rest. But nobody has these cards anymore. They're built into the motherboards. The radios are built into the laptops. So
I got one.
You got one?
Yeah.
You want to show us?
You don't
have it here. See, that's where mine is too, because I don't need it here. I have a bunch of them actually. You can have even things like modems over telephone lines, implementing sort of the low layers of a link layer, the lower parts of a link layer, with the rest of it implemented by something like PPPD in the operating system, the point-to-point protocol daemon. So it's implementing a link layer over which you can then run the IP network layer. I don't know. It just says you take your datagrams and you stick them in frames. Okay? And that involves more bits on the front and more on the back, and when it gets there, they come off. You know, that's sort of the usual story. So assuming you want to do error detection, how does it work? The general principle is just like we saw before with TCP and UDP. You have some sort of checksum, some additional bits that get added to the frame that provide redundancy that let you detect when errors occur. So here are the basic bits. Here's the error detection and correction bits. You send the combination over the link. You check at the end whether the checksum bits match the data bits, and if they don't, you don't deliver the datagram. Okay, so that's the sort of general idea. But let's look at some specific techniques for doing this. We already talked about the internet checksum, but here are some others. One idea is to compute parity, so-called parity, of the message. And you can do this over the whole message. You can do it over every byte in the message. Lots of different ways, but simply parity means to choose either to make the number of one bits in the message odd, so-called odd parity, or even. So this example here is the data bits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So this is an odd parity representation.
of however many bits this is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 16 bits. Okay, so 16 bits, add one more bit to make it odd or even parity. Number of one bits. So on modem connections, this is you know, usually part of the setup of the serial port, where you say, I want even parity, 8 bits in my characters, and so forth. And what does it allow you to do? Well, if any one bit in here gets flipped, you can detect that happened and say that was a bad character. And if you're doing this for every character in a message, then the whole message is considered corrupt, say, and you throw it away. Another possibility is to split your message, say these. Maybe we have 4 16-bit words. We do a parity bit and we do a parity word. I'm just really redrawing what's over on this other side, but maybe with longer words. And so we, you know, think of these 4 16-bit words as actually being strung out one after the other as being the whole message, but we now add a 5th 16-bit or 17-bit word containing the parity of all the others in the so-called vertical direction. So, yeah, row parity and column parity. If you do that, then suppose that you have a parity error. Suppose a bit gets flipped. Then it's going to have the wrong parity in the row direction, the wrong parity in the column direction, and by saying which column and which row, you know which bit it was that got flipped. Okay? Question is, the only thing that's a little ambiguous here is what is the value of that lower right corner bit supposed to be. I guess you could decide to do it either way, but you can't do it necessarily both ways, right? Because you can't have necessarily even parity along there and even parity along there. Okay? That's parity. So that's probably the easiest version of error checking. We talked about internet checksum, so let's not do that again. The other common technique for many years for doing error checking is the so-called cyclic redundancy check. Now, notice that in our parity scheme, we're really only guaranteed to be able to detect one error. If 2 bits get flipped here, say that one and that one, no, that doesn't work. Well, if 2 bits get flipped, it's possible for 2 bits to be flipped and still have correct parity, okay, for everything. So, that's maybe not good enough. So the idea of the cyclic redundancy check is a much more robust error check. And the way it works, we're gonna see how it works here in a second. But what do I want to say about this? Okay, yes. So you choose a bunch of extra bits, just as usual, and you choose them in a particular way. Think of the data bits
as being a number. And if we add more bits to its right, that's like multiplying that number by 2 to the r, if we add r bits. Right? That's what you do when you multiply by 2 to the r, you essentially shift left by r bits. So to make this calculation, you start with the data bits, and you add some redundancy bits, the CRC bits, and you do it so that this entire number, when divided by a special magic number called G, yields a remainder of zero. Now, why that works is sort of a result of number theory, which, you know, we're not going to do. But I am going to show you the algorithm. So, the first thing to know is that arithmetic here, arithmetic for CRCs, is base 2 with no carries or borrows. That means that plus and minus are both really XOR. Think about that. Think about the truth table for. Think about the truth table for addition and subtraction without carries or borrows, and it's this. And so that's really just XOR. Right? So that's why you see XOR on here all the time. But you can also think of it as really doing arithmetic. So we want our data times 2 to the R, that is shifted left, plus R, which then fills in the R bits at the right-hand edge, to be equal to some n, unknown, and which we don't care about, times g, which is called the generator value. So that when on receiving this number, d times 2 to the r x or r, and dividing it by g, we get no remainder. That says it's correct. Well, that's what we want. We can algebraically rewrite that as d times 2 to the r. Think of this as plus, and just the usual, well, think of it as plus and minus, just the usual algebraic manipulation. That's what you get. And so what we do is we divide d times 2 to the r by g and take the remainder r as the r bits that get put on to the number. So how does this go? It's straightforward as long as you remember there are no carries or borrows. Right? So if our g is 1001, well, you need 4 bits worth, starting with a 1, for that to go. So you say 1, and 1 times, you subtract, you get 101. You get 1, 0 as the remainder, bring down a 1, it won't go. So bring down another value, it does go. The other thing you have to remember is that with this kind of division, that if you've got a 1 bit here and a 1 bit there, it does go into it in some fashion.
even if it doesn't look like a bigger binary number, because we're not really doing sort of two's complement numbers here or powers of two as the values. We're just treating each bit independently, essentially. No carries or problems. So, now this is not, I guess I don't have an example of where this happens here, but okay, so you see how that goes. And at the end, you get to a point where you've figured out the quotient n. And the remainder. And so what we do is we then transmit 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. We'll just put a little mark in there, 0, 1, 1, as the value that we finally transmit as our message. Okay? And at the other end, then, if you divide this by the generator, what you'll find out is that the remainder is zero. Okay? So you should be able to do this manipulation. Okay. It's explained in the book as well. But just keep in mind, no carries or borrows. That will make life better. Well, what good does a CRC do? We don't actually have a slide. CRC detects any burst of errors of length less than or equal to R. Oops, R, little r. Okay. And also any odd number of error flipped bits. So it's a lot more robust than just parity, okay, at detecting errors. And the interesting thing about bursts is that for a lot of communication channels, that's the kind of errors that you get. Right? That you transmit a one, say you transmit 110011, and you receive 10111. Okay, so that was a burst of errors. Okay, they were all together. All the errors were together in one place in the message. And that's very typical of transmission media, because the interference, whatever it is not synchronized to the bit transmission. And so it corrupts a bunch of bits close together. Okay? Questions about that? There's a lot of mathematical theory about error checking codes. You run into them in communications. The other place that they're used really extensively is in disk drive, design of disk drives, because you've got little tiny magnetic fields recorded on the medium, and it's a very noisy channel, and so they record a whole lot more bits on the disk than you actually ever manage to extract out of it. And all that extra stuff is coding of this kind to ensure that you get back the right data almost all the time. So the people who do that are typically double E's. That's or mathematicians. Those are the two fields that work on coding theory a lot. Okay, so that was error detection and correction. We'll move on and now talk about multiple access protocols. So this is for so-called broadcast media. Things like wireless networks, Ethernet, old-style Ethernet anyway. Situations where essentially every receiver can hear every transmitter all the time, continuously. or at least many receivers can hear many transmitters all the time continuously. If that's what's going on, you certainly can't have multiple transmitters transmitting at the same time, or they will interfere with each other. And the receivers will not be able to detect the correct signal. So to handle that, we have these things called multiple access protocols that are all about the rules. That's what a protocol is, a set of rules. The rules that transmitters and receivers have to follow when using this medium, whatever it is. So, we're not interested in point-to-point protocols here. Broadcast. Said all that. Oh, the technical term for a receiver's receiving signals from two or more transmitters at the same time is a collision. This is different from general interference in that general interference can be sort of on a radio channel, can be from things that are not participating in the protocol at all, right? That wouldn't be called a collision. It's a collision if everybody's playing by the protocol. So you have to figure out who can transmit. And one of the cool things about this is you have to do it without having a separate channel for doing coordination, right? The assumption is that you're doing all of this in the same space that you're also transmitting data. So what do we want? Well, if you had a channel with r bits per second capacity, the ideal thing would be that if one person wants to transmit, then that person can use the full available bandwidth of the channel, and that if several want to transmit, they can share it. That would be the ideal situation. If you ever take distributed computing, you'll recognize that globally synchronizing clocks is a challenging problem, so you don't want to do that. And you probably don't want to have a special node responsible for doing the coordination, although some link layers do. They're so-called master-slave configurations, where one node determines who gets to transmit next. So you want to, ideally it's decentralized and it's simple. Okay. So ways to approach it that succeed variously in achieving the ideals. One idea is to chop up the channel, and we talked about this before at some point, where we said we'll divide the channel into smaller pieces and assign each transmitter a slot, either a frequency slot or a time slot, or nowadays what's called a code division slot. So we just allocate to each transmitter a certain slot. How does that fail to achieve the goals? Where does that break down? The single sender situation, right, doesn't use all the bandwidth, right? He only gets his nth of the slot. So that's, you know, not ideal. Another possibility is to do random access, where we let the the senders just try to use it and let collisions happen and make sure that when they happen, we don't actually use the results of the messages that are received, going back to the error checking. We're going to look at some examples of those in detail. And finally, you could have a scheme where nodes with more to send get longer turns, but you still take turns. This has a more complicated a control algorithm, maybe, than random access does. We'll look at an example of one of those, too. Okay, so I think this is obvious from what we've said before. One. Frequency division multiplexing is sometimes a little mysterious to people, but I think it's now that we've moved to optical fiber communications, it's easier to understand because I can appeal to an analogy that is very much bound in the senses. So suppose that Vic and DeAndre and Nick are sitting at the back of the room and they're all trying to send me messages over a channel that involves different colors of light, right? Well, they can blink their lights on and off, and I can distinguish between them simply on the basis of color, even if they emerge from one point, right? I can tell them apart by the color. Well, frequency of electrical signals is nothing more than essentially the same thing as different colors of light. Okay? So if I have carriers at different frequencies, I turn them on and off or change their intensity or something, that can be decoded out of the medium. Okay? So that's frequency division multiplexing. But it has the same issue that time division multiplexing had, in that each sender only still gets one nth of the available bandwidth, regardless of how much or how little the others have to send. Okay, so those frequency division schemes are used in situations where you just really want to ensure that senders have always available a certain amount of bandwidth. And what you pay for it is wasted bandwidth when they don't use it. Okay? They are used, definitely. What made networking take off, though, was the Ethernet invention in the late 1970s. And that's an example of a random access protocol. It, we'll see, has pretty good utilization of the available bandwidth, and it has a really simple set of rules to use. And we'll work our way up to it. So, the most basic idea is that if you have something to send, you send it. You start sending it. And if somebody else is sending at the same time, the receivers detect a collision. Well, somebody detects collisions. and you retransmit. And so the protocol becomes the rules for detecting collisions and for retransmitting. So we're going to start with a slotted aloha and then work our way up to the protocols used by Ethernet. So this was a slotted aloha. Aloha was actually a wireless network that was developed in Hawaii for communicating, I think, between various University of Hawaii campuses. And that's why it's Aloha. Okay. And this was early 1970s, okay? So nobody had really done anything like this at that time. There was no internet, certainly. About all there was telephones and modems and teletypewriters that went clunk, clunk, clunk when you typed on the keys. Very physical. But anyway, so the idea here is that it does require synchronization of time, and you transmit only beginning at the beginning of a slot, right, which is big enough to hold the frames that you have. So you're able to tell if a collision occurred. You listen and send at the same time, and you're able to tell if a collision occurred. If there was no collision, you assume there was success, and leaving recovery from other things that happened to the higher layers. If there was a collision, and this is where things start to get interesting, you don't necessarily rebroadcast in the next slot, but rather you only broadcast again with probability P. Okay? And so P is then adjusted, that probability is adjusted so that it becomes likely that somebody will succeed. And if collision happens again in the next slot, maybe you back off even further and use a even smaller P, right? So that you eventually end up with only one person sending in the slot. He succeeds, and then the others continue retrying until they succeed. Illustration. So the good thing is that if there's only one node transmitting, he can go at full speed because there'll be no collisions. It's completely decentralized, except for the need to synchronize time, and it's very simple. So you have what wastes bandwidth is collisions, and then following collisions, it may be that nobody tries in a slot, right? Because everybody tries with probability P, that allows the possibility that nobody transmits. So you waste that slot as well. And also, when you have a collision, you waste the whole slot, because everything is synchronized to the slots. Okay, so next thing they did was say, let's get rid of, So when you have multiple senders, 37% of the available bandwidth. At best. Okay. Well, another thing to try is no time synchronization. Just try to send when you can. Still detect collisions, and when you detect a collision, back off and don't send for a while. Analysis, half the efficiency of the previous slotted version, but you didn't have to do clock synchronization. So not very good, right? You put up a megabit per second link, and you get 180 kilobits use out of it. So, how to improve things? We'll talk about this beginning next time. The idea is, as every good ham radio operator knows, listen before transmit. If somebody is already using the channel, there's no point in your trying to use it. You only destroy what he's doing, and yours isn't any good either. Right? So, essentially, listen before transmit is the first step toward improving these channel efficiencies. And we'll work through the rest of them next time. Okay? So that's it for this. Have any questions about the homeworks, shoot them to me by email. And I think that's it.
Okay? Review on Wednesday.
Pardon?
We have a review on Wednesday.
You have a review on Wednesday next week.
Next week?
Next week. The exam is next week. The exam is next week.
I'm in
here.
Yeah, I have a question for problem one.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure this big string is correct or not.
Okay, let me read it and see. Well, the question is, is there a common prefix here?
Yes.
And, oh, well, yes, there is.
It this one is 225.
Pardon?
This one is 225.
Uh-huh.
It goes to different interface.
I think it's okay. I think all these numbers are bigger than the last. Yeah, I think it should be okay.
So, for example, for this one,
uh-huh.
Common prefix bit is this.
Yes.
And we have this input. We uh-huh. have to go interface to 1100. That's right. So this is our input.
Okay, this is our input, and it's going to go one. No, this is an otherwise.
Yes, but it matches to the prefix of this. So I just.
That's okay. I mean, that's okay.
But this one has to be in.
This is otherwise. Yeah.
But the prefix of this match to this. And this
but,
is a long.
But think about what you have to have as the prefix for. Think about what you have to have in the routing table
mm-hmm.
to implement this.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that. That you'll have to have an entry that starts like this,
mm-hmm.
actually like this, in order to achieve this.
Okay.
Yeah? This is all fine. We have to have a way to make this work.
Okay.
Is I think the short answer.
Okay.
Okay. There has to be a way to make this work because all these ranges are disjoint, and so, you may need more than one rule for otherwise.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
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 Yes, I got it. Thanks.
Uh huh.